Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we are joined by a guy called Mike Vegman. Now, Mike is involved with the Beach Token, which we have discussed a little bit before on the Market Musings podcast. Of course, a big part of Beach Token is cleaning the seas and ridding the beaches and the seas of plastic, but also the marine life as well, the whole plastic pollution. And with Mike's background in the military, he's got a few stories to share with us about the plastics problem. So looking forward to discussing that, Mike, and some of the perhaps things that Beach are doing to help clean that up. But you're very welcome. How are you?
I'm very well, Mark. Thank you. And thanks you and Kenny for having me on the program today.
No problem. And of course, Kenny is in the background as well. Hello, Kenny.
Yeah, I'm always lurking in the background, Mark. You're the front. You're the front man. I just hide in your shadow. So it's great to have you on, Mike. And obviously, we've spoke at length before, so I know a bit about your background, but I'm not going to spoil it for our listeners. But obviously, Mark, you're in Holland. I'm in Scotland, and Mike, you're in the States. So whereabouts in the States are you?
I am in the great state of North Carolina, just on the East Coast. I'm about 90 miles from the coastline.
All right, lovely. Yeah, Carolina has, I used to watch a lot of college football. I can't remember the name of the team. It was mad watching some of the college football games. It was like 100,000 people in a bowl, you know, watching the college games. It was amazing, but no, it's great to have you on. And obviously, you know, we're going to talk about Beach Token or the Beach Ethos at length later on. But what we like to do with our guests is, you know, just settle them in and almost get like a potted history of Mike, you know, where you were born, you know, what it was like growing up. And obviously, we know you've got a naval background, so you can tell us a bit about your journey in the Navy. And really, it's just the floor's yours for sort of 10, 15 minutes, and myself and Mark will just jump in at an appropriate time and maybe ask a few more questions. So over to you, Mike. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And I'll give you what I like to call the Reader's Digest version, the RDV of Mike Vegman. I'm in the hometown that I grew up in. So once I finally retired from the Navy, I moved home here to a place called Goldsboro. It's a nice small town. It's home to a big Air Force base. And what brought me here a lot of years ago, 55 years ago, was my father was an aviator with the Air Force. So we moved here. I was originally born on an Air Force base in Madrid, Spain. And then we moved, got orders to Ohio, and eventually here to North Carolina, where we settled. And so after all those years growing up on Air Force bases, I just felt like I had already done a career in the Air Force. I knew I wanted to be in the military. I was intrigued by the military. I was a very patriotic child growing up. And so I was also a surfer. I was also a skateboarder. And so it seemed to me like, well, the Navy, being that they do their business at sea, seemed like a good fit for me. So I went in and saw the recruiter, and well, the rest is history. That was in 1978, September of 1978, became a nuclear submariner. Did that for about 4 years, and then they, I guess, recognized maybe some element of leadership in me. They look at enlisted folks pretty closely. If they can determine, at least in the Navy, they can determine that you have some leadership potential, they want to certainly tap into that. And so they did. They sent me down to a school in the state of Alabama called Auburn. Speaking of football, we play a little football at Auburn. But in any event, so that was, it got me into the surface Navy. After that, I was commissioned in 1987 became a surface warfare officer after my schooling, and landed on my first ship in Norfolk, Virginia, and then my second ship, and it was a pair of an auxiliary ship. It was an oiler, and then also a destroyer. And so from there, was able to spend a lot of time at sea. When you're submarining, you don't really see a lot. I mean, we do surface periodically for swim call, and we'll, you know, put a couple of guys with M14s out on the fair water plains and just to keep the sharks at bay, and we'll swim. But it's not a lot of noticing of water when you're a submariner. But years later, as a surface warfare line officer, I spent an inordinate amount of time at sea. And then I eventually served on a couple of aircraft carriers, a command and control ship. And so been around quite a few diverse number of or types of different ships. And what I saw out there was really, and this was a long time ago, I can only surmise that it's far worse now, but back then it was a lot of debris in the water. And what I came to understand was light only penetrates to about 200 meters. So about 600 feet is all you're going to get light. Beyond that, it's just pitch dark. And that's where the predominant number of, you know, sea life is, below 600 feet, it's down to thousands of feet. That's all in the darkness. And if you could shine a light on it, I'm certain you would see an enormous amount of floating, you know, plastic that's neutrally buoyant. So it's just, it's not sinking and it's not necessarily riding up on the surface, but it's just suspended at those various depths. And it's just kind of a cesspool out there, really needs to be cleaned up.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a tip of the iceberg. I mean, we see this, the stuff at the surface, but as you say, the, you know, the oceans are, you know, more than several thousand feet deep. So, you know, who knows what's at the bottom. I must admit, I've been down the submarine myself quite a few times. I've never been to sea. I was fortunate enough to work in the Naval Base and assisted some of the guys with some work. But I don't think I could go to sea in a submarine. It takes a special kind of person. So it does. I was down there for 4 hours, and I was glad to get back to the hatch and get some fresh air. It's very, very, very oppressive. But I take my hats off to these guys that will do that for 90 days or even 100 days or even longer. It's an impressive career. Yeah.
And one interesting thing that I'll tell you guys that most people don't, it doesn't occur to them until I mention it. And then they're like, oh yeah, I never really thought about that. But when you're feeding a crew of, in our case, we had 130 folks on board there. We had 130 sailors. So there was a certain number of officers and then the rest were enlisted men. And it was all men. Today it's unisex, but back then it was, men and women back now, but back then it was just guys. But we generate a lot of garbage. We generate a lot of trash. Some of it's biodegradable. A lot of it is not. And so what we do is we have something called the trash disposal unit. We just refer to it as the TDU. And we load that TDU can with garbage, leftover food, leftover, you know, packaging, plastic, cardboard, you name it. We jam all that down in there. We use a hydraulic ram to squish it down in that can. And then we weigh the can. And once the TDU can weighs, I forget what the weight is now. I want to say 67 pounds. If it doesn't weigh enough, but it's full volume wise, we'll throw some weights over there until we get it to 67 pounds or more. And then we'll seal it up. We'll load it down into the trash disposal chute. And once that's full, then we'll come up to periscope depth where the, you know, seawater pressure is considerably less. We'll open the bottom ball valve and we'll just eject all those TDU cans out and they will float to the bottom of the ocean. That's no secret. I mean, most navies do that.
Yeah.
But I imagine if you could suck all the water out of the oceans for a minute and take a look, you'd see literally millions of TDU cans on the bottom of the ocean floor. I suspect, you know, they're made out of aluminum. So at some point they, you know, the seawater has their way with them, but still it's an interesting thing that we did with our garbage. I just wanted to mention that. So.
Yeah. You think how many navies around the world. It's a lot of garbage, but obviously there's an interesting part to your story as well, Mike, that you retired from the Navy. I think it was in the late 90s. Is that correct?
I retired in 2014, and not knowing, I was 55 years old then, so not knowing exactly where to go, what to do at 55, you know, you're not 60-something and you're not 40-something, so it's hard to market and figure out where you want to go. But there was an opening in one of the local high schools for a Navy junior ROTC instructor, and you had to be an officer. And so, I mean, it just all kind of worked out providentially. And I taught there for about 6 years. So I was a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. And it was a great experience. It was absolutely a great experience. It was an opportunity for me to use my years of experience and education to give back to high school students, who many of which really never met a guy like me. I mean, they don't go home to a neighborhood where there's retired Navy commanders hanging out. So, you know, and likewise, I mean, I was exposed to a lot of young folks that typically don't frequent my circles. So, I mean, it worked both ways. It was very amazing and a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
But COVID hit, and I just didn't feel like I could teach young men and women how to be, how to do what we do in ROTC. I couldn't do that virtually. So I told my principal that I was going to go ahead and retire, and got a small pension. So I was able to retire. And so here I am.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking back, was there not a gap around about 9/11 when you'd actually sort of left the Navy and then you get called back up because of what happened?
Yeah. I'm sorry. So, yeah, I guess the chronology, I got to go back to the early 90s. We had just, my wife and I had just had our second daughter. So now there were two little girls to help raise. And here I was a destroyer officer. I knew that I would not see my girls, nor would they see me, because what I do is out on the ocean. So we made a decision that I would transfer my commission from the active forces over into the reserves. And then I went to work for a large brokerage firm, and I was a stockbroker. Eventually I transitioned from stockbroker to financial advisor. Got some additional education in financial advising, financial planning, and did that for about 10, 11 years until after 9/11, as a reserve officer, I began to be recalled periodically back to active duty. And I was recalled in 2002 after 9/11, recalled again in 2006, and went over to the Middle East, and actually as a senior naval officer, ran an army facility. It was an army, I just call it a prison. It was a detention center, a confinement facility. And then eventually found my way as a staff officer on a couple of 3- and 4-star staffs until I retired in 2014. So pretty diverse background. I kind of did a little bit of everything. I wrote a book in 2004, self-published that book, and it's for sale over on Amazon. So you know, just and dabble in writing. Writing is just one of those things that, you know, my dad used to say to his 7 children, be smart enough to know what you're good at. Be smart enough also to know what you're not good at. And so there's a whole laundry list of things that I'm just not very good at. But I feel like I've been given a pretty good gift of writing. And part of that is the passion that I have. I enjoy writing. I actually love to write. So it's my pleasure helping out with some of the Medium articles, Kenny. I know you're the lead guy on that, but I love helping out with some of those for Beach Token.
Yeah, we'll come to Beach Talking in 2 seconds. No, I think I've actually resigned now, Mike. I'm just the editor. You're the chief writer.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Yeah. No, I used to write those articles like in a 10-15 minute window about 6:30 in the morning, and they were always they were always rushed, and you know, and then somebody would pick up a spelling mistake, and so I'm delighted that we've got yourself on board now that you can take some of that pressure off me, because my articles are more about, you know, what's happened within the token, where yours are more wide ranging and cover a lot of topics that I just don't have knowledge about. So it's a blessing to have you on board. And then
I'm happy to do it, and thank you. And I'm happy to do it. And my graduate degree is a research degree, so it helps to have some background educationally to be able to drill down and find some factual data and then know how to make sure to give credit where credit is due when you're putting that to the pen.
Obviously, Mark, you've got a bit of Navy experience as well, because you were in the reserves for a while.
I was in the reserves for 3 years. Yeah, it was while I was at university. It's not, I can't claim to be a proper, I don't know, active serving member of the armed forces. I suppose, but 3 years in the reserves. But yeah, I did a bit of a taste. Never went on a submarine, unfortunately. But I did go on a few different ships with different deployments. Learned an awful lot. Still have a lot of interest in it. My brother's joined the Navy. He's going through his professional training to be a winchman right now. So my grandfather was in the Merchant Navy. My other granddad was in the Navy in the Second World War. There's a bit of a family history of Navy.
Nautical family, yeah.
Yeah, my dad was going to join, but he went to work for Massey Ferguson instead. So that's why. I'm not sure why. Maybe my mother persuaded him not to. It could work.
Massey's a good company.
Yeah, he had a good time there. He certainly did, made a good career there before starting his own company. So, so a little bit of Navy history in my family. But one thing I wish I could have done was get on a sub. I didn't even get. I never went on one, and that was always something I wanted to to go on.
The thing is, Mark, the Yank subs were massive compared to the UK ones. So the UK ones are just tiny in comparison. So they are. I'm not saying Mike's submarine, but they would have a lot more room, but they're certainly a lot bigger. I'm trying to think, is about 170, 180 meters. Some of these kind of Ohio class. Is it Ohio class? I'm trying to think. Is that the submarine class?
Yeah, it is Ohio class, and that's a ballistic missile submarine. So I was on a fast attack. I was never on a ballistic missile submarine. The ballistic missile submarine is the one that carries the ballistic missiles that are nuclear tipped, and it goes out. And, you know, if it hears a sound, it goes the other way. It's trying to remain stealthy. It doesn't want anybody to know where it is. If the word ever comes to launch its payload, then that's its mission. And it's out there usually on a 90-day patrol.
Yeah.
My submarine was a fast attack sub. When we heard something out there, we went over and investigated it, and we trailed it until we could classify it, and we figured out what it was. And then we would, if it needed reporting, we would report it. So it was, and I served on submarines during the Reagan administration, during the Cold War. So there was a lot of interesting times when we knew there were Soviet submarines in the area, and we would tag along and, you know, for surveil them. That's what we did.
Yeah, it's all a big game, but obviously it's just the way the world is. So we just go on with it. But all right, we've kind of covered your naval career, Mike, and you've told a bit about your family. So let's move on to Beach. Obviously, we know each other through Beach. I'd never met you before the Beach Token. So what was it attracted you to Beach?
Well, Kenny, for me, I've been involved in investing for most of my life, and the investments, whether they were stock or now crypto for about 4 years now. This is about my fourth year involved in cryptocurrency, and for me, the criteria always was I needed to see something there that lit a fire under me. It made me feel like I was participating in a worthy venture. And when I looked, drilled down on Beach Token, and I realized that trying to help the planet, a planet that I think needs a lot of help, and that was just the attraction for me. And I think, you know, but look, beyond the project, because there's a lot of projects out there with use cases that are run by people who, you know, they don't seem genuine. And I've been involved in some of those projects, and they're kind of a dead end, some of them. But this one, for me, the tiebreaker wasn't even the use case, which is fantastic. It was the people. And when I got involved with the Telegram group as a moderator, and when I got involved with you, Kenny, and with Chris, and with and several of the others in the mod group, what I learned was that this is a group of people I want to be friends with. I mean, this is a group of people who care. They know what I know, which is, to fix this thing, it starts with individuals. You know, if we think we're going to wave a magic wand corporately and it's all going to get cleaned up and it's going to be neat and tidy and it's going to be all technologically a done deal, it starts with our individual behaviors in our homes, starts with our attitudes. And so I saw a lot of that. I heard a lot of that. I read a lot of that. And I just said, this is a group of folks and a project that I want to be a part of. So here I am.
Yeah. So it was the people behind it then, the community that attracted you.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, more than anything. Absolutely.
Yeah. Obviously I work with Mark in a few businesses. So he's maybe once the recording's finished, he can tell you what he thinks of me, but no, I'm only kidding. But
no, but no, I mean, we talk to a lot of people in the stock market, don't we? And yeah. A lot of people's investing criteria is the people behind the business. I mean, that is what this podcast is founded on, the people behind the business.
Yeah, you can have the best assets in the world, the best projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people to manage them, then, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you're pissing against the wind. So, yeah, I must admit, I mean, Mike, I mean, I live in the coast, so I'm aware of, you know, every time we get a storm in some of these sea lochs in Scotland, you know, everything is just dumped upon the beaches. But it was only when I joined Beach and I got involved, a bit like the same as yourself. Well, actually, I'll tell a lie, I've been there since the beginning, but obviously we were talking about Beach, you know, for several months, you know, what we could do, how we could get involved. And some of the stuff I've learned is just amazing. And the energy that some of the people have got in the team as well. I mean, we've all got full-time jobs, or several businesses or whatever we're doing. And yeah, you know, people still find 5-6 hours in a day to put into this. It's a virtuous circle we're creating. And I mean, a classic example, and you've seen the media and you've written about it as well, Mike, is obviously we've got a community in the Philippines now that are actively cleaning their beaches, they're cleaning areas for mangrove planting. And, you know, we've just empowered them. And that was just one person that said, you know, I'm going to make a difference. And before they know it, they've got a whole army of helpers. You know, we've got a dive team out there as well. And, you know, it just takes one person. And I think that's the way to do it. If you can do it one person at a time, and that person, you know, shines a little light and stands out as a good example, then people will follow and join. And, you know, we just need, when the young lady in question is called Barbs, you know, we just need 100 Barbs around the world, you know, and we'll actually be making a serious difference. So, no, I'm excited for the future of Beach. I mean, we're doing all sorts. We're looking at kelp farm investing, and, you know, obviously we've got funds for the blue carbon initiatives as well. So, I mean, there's just so much you can be doing. And even from an investing side of things, I'm starting to look at, you know, seaweed farms and seaweed and kelp farms as potential investment opportunities. You know, it's mind-blowing what's out there. Mm. You know, seaweed is the second biggest harvest out of the sea after fishing, which I didn't even think about before, you know. But and you go to places in Southeast Asia, and you know, it's massive. You know, the amount of, you know, commercial seaweed fishing is going on out there. Probably too commercial. It's probably doing damage.
And is that what some of the things you want to get involved with then at Beach then, is to actually get involved with these kelp farms to help remove carbon?
So obviously there's several benefits for the kelp farm, Mark. I mean, the kelp farms, the way they work is they usually put out 100-meter lines. You've always got the kelp growing vertically. It grows at a ridiculous speed. You know, I can't remember the exact... I think it's like a foot every 2 or 3 days. It's just a scary amount. You know, I think you can get types of bamboo that grows like a foot a day as well. You know, there is some really weird plants out there and that can grow at ridiculous rates. And obviously when that starts to grow, it creates its whole ecosystem. You've got shellfish, you've got small fish, it provides shelter. You know, and it's obviously taking carbon out, sequestering carbon as well. And I think kelp, we all think that rainforests are the best carbon sequesters, but it's actually kelp and seaweed. It's actually four times better. So there's huge benefits for kelp farming, and it grows extremely well in cold water temperatures. So in Europe, I think Norway is probably one of the biggest producers, just simply because of the temperature of the water. So I think anything below 10, and it just grows 10 degrees centigrade, it grows phenomenally well. So typically in Scotland, the growing season is probably about September to April. That's the growing season for the kelp, because obviously the water is a lot cooler. So, you know, that's what we're looking at in Beach, potential opportunities around the UK. But we won't limit it to the UK. We'll look elsewhere as well. But obviously the UK is close for most of us guys, so we can, you know, we can do a lot of due diligence on it, etc., if required. So, but the world's our oyster. We're not limiting ourselves to the UK. If there's something comes up in the States, or there's something comes up in Southeast Asia, you know, we'll pay it as much attention.
And you're open to suggestions on that front then?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, we are getting people approaching us now that have got, you know, various projects going on around the world. So it's actually frightening. We used to do all this in a Telegram chat room, and now we've had to move to a Discord server because there's so many work streams, so many projects.
Okay.
It was just impossible to track everything.
So you're really finding the pace is sort of ramping up, or the interest is ramping up?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Well, that's good.
Oh, it's good. It's good, but obviously, you know, it's an increased workload. Obviously, yeah. But the token, you know, I think the market cap of both tokens is about $4 million at the moment. We've got obviously an Ethereum one, and we've got a Binance Smart Chain one. But the good thing is, as interest grows, you know, we're getting more funds in through our tokenomics, we might be able to start, you know, actually physically, you know, bringing, I'm not saying you're not professional, but you can bring in people that are specialized in running certain parts of it. But it's effectively, it's a business we're running. That's what it is. It needs business people to streamline it, to make it efficient, to take ownership as well. Because you can't leave it for somebody else. If you've got a task, you need to do it. As simple as that, we just go in and get it done. But people seem to love what we're doing. We're getting great feedback. All the socials are growing at a phenomenal rate. Mm-hmm. So,
and of course, it was started, wasn't it, for the plastics problem, wasn't it? Originally, that was the main thing. But of course, there's lots of uses to for the environment and reducing the carbon footprint. But you know, we've obviously got Mike who has seen a few things, I think, haven't you? And you do the research and you write the articles on the plastic problem. So have you got some stories you can share with us, Mike?
I do. I mean, I've laid on the beaches on several different continents, so I've been exposed to what's going on around the world. I think I like the saying, act locally, think globally. I know that's an old a colloquial expression, but it's so true when we apply that, when we overlay that onto what Beach Token is doing, because the problem really is a global problem, but the fix is a local fix. And Kenny, when you said a moment ago about the talking about the cold water, and, you know, things that grow well in cold water, for the warm water, I like that beach is planting mangroves, because if you know, if you really look at mangrove forests and you see how much carbon they take out, they're 2 to 4 times as efficient as a standalone forest. And so you've got these mangrove forests that work in conjunction with the seaweed and with the coral reefs, acting as nurseries and, you know, and incubators for all kinds of life that allows the sea life to flourish. I like the fact that around the world, we have plans. I think it's already being done, but we have plans to expand planting mangrove forests. That's something I want to be a part of, and I'll fly wherever I got to fly to do that. But I in 1981, the Navy chose me to go to Navy Diver School. And so I went to New London, Connecticut for a month and became a Navy diver, scuba diver. And so for the next 3 years that I was on the submarine, 2 years actually, I spent a lot of time in the water underneath submarine and underneath in areas around the submarine. And I saw a lot of the debris. And I think that people don't think anything about throwing stuff over the side on vessels, and I've seen private boaters do it. And so I think if we could just begin to change the minds of people to realize that littering that you can't see is still littering, you know, because a lot of it, they say, well, it's going to sink. Well, you know, you add water to that can, that soda can, and it sinks, that's fine, but it's still there. And so I think it's, you know, it's something we've got to work on globally, is to begin to change the minds of people about what constitutes littering.
Yeah, I mean, obviously with the beach as well, we quickly discovered, just as you said, Mike, that education is going to be key for us going forward as well. You know, we've got to, I'm not blaming my generation, but probably is my generation is to blame, and I'm 49. Probably our generation is to blame for a lot of the attitudes towards rubbish. So we shouldn't make the same mistake with our kids. So that's something Beach Token we're trying to do as well. We've engaged with a couple of schools, and you know, we've gave them supplies, and the teachers are running projects to do with the beach. So we're trying to educate. It's just it's just one school out of, you know, hundreds of thousands of schools around the world. But you know, if we can do it with one school and another school in the area hears about it and then they want to do it, then you just create this domino effect. So
I think Kenny, if I can just add that, I think the other challenge here is you know, it's the low-hanging fruit of this whole cleanup business is the stuff that washes up on the shoreline, because it's, you know, you see it, it's visible. So you go and you pick it up. Great. You collect all this. The bigger challenge obviously is going to be out on the oceans. And I've read that there are some companies that have some very innovative ways to find, locate, and drag this material all together. Kind of like they do with fish. They put a net, you know, got two boats working in tandem, and they put this net behind both of them, and then they circle around and they collect all the fish in the net. So it would be the same thing with some of these plastic deposits around the nation. But so you get all this plastic picked up and you pull it all to the shoreline in massive quantities. And the question becomes, then what? What do you do with it?
Yeah.
And if you look at the inordinate amount of cost involved in recycling, bona fide recycling, and then you look at the monies around the world and the allocation of money around the world, you realize there are a lot of poor nations out there, you know, developing nations and even developed countries that just don't have the infrastructure to support recycling all of this debris. You get it all picked up, and then what? You got to sort it. You got to sort it by type. You have to sort it by color. Then you have to chop it up. You have to, you know, make it into something that is useful. And that whole thing is an expensive process that we need to take on board as a world, as a globe. We need to decide that investing in recycling plants every certain number of square miles, it's just a good thing to do. I mean, I don't know how many each country needs, but they need recycling plants that can handle the, and I don't have it in front of me now, but there's a slide that shows about 7 or 8, 9 different types of recycling according to, you know, what it is and its composition and its chemistry. We need that capacity. Otherwise, picking up garbage and saying, hey, we're recycling, it still falls short. That makes sense?
Yeah, it's like a Pandora's box. You know, we're only scratching the surface, and there is a lot of, you know, other problems that we need to address as well. But, you know, I think just, not to end the podcast, but I think just a point about Beach that I'd like to put out there as well is that if you imagine one that some of these big multinational charities that you donate a dollar to, you know, by the time it actually reaches the guy or the person on the ground, you know, it's 10 cents. You know, 90 cents of that spent on CEO wages, director wages, marketing again.
Administrative costs,
So that, you know, 90% of your dollar's gone before it even reaches the person that was you thought you were giving a dollar to. Beach, everything that we have got so far, you know, we've deployed. You know, I'm not taking a salary or that. Nobody's paid. We do have some admin tokens, but that's part and parcel of starting up a token. That's just the way it works, but nobody takes like a, you know, monthly payment or nothing. We just do it, and we try to make sure that everything that we've got in our various funds or pots is and will be allocated 100% towards to do good, because that's a slogan. It's do good with every transaction.
Yep, I like that. And that's just good stewardship. It's just good stewardship of people's investable dollars. People want to know that there's, you know, whoever's behind the project is being a good steward of their money.
Yeah.
Investing.
Yeah. Lots of things going on. What you mentioned earlier, Kenny, about sort of individual people doing things, as Barb, for example. What sort of definitive actions are Beach doing right now then to address the plastics problem? Give an example of this mangrove planting, for example, or this clean the beaches in the Philippines. How have you instigated that and perpetuating its activity?
Yeah, well, so I mean, it was really bizarre the way. I mean, there's two or three people we're actually working with in the Philippines. I think we'll see some media over the next couple of days from another two individuals that are basically want to replicate exactly what Barb's is doing. But Barb's actually came about, bizarrely enough, we ran a competition to give away some beach tokens to clean your local beach. And Barb's done it, and she put together a wee video, and it was really professional. And, you know, you just reach out and you find out a bit about them, and, you know, and you think, well, do you know what? Sometimes I'm on about my life, but actually, you know, I'm doing pretty damn well. You know, when you hear some of the stories about people around the world and, you know, how much they earn or how many hours they've got to work and the conditions, et cetera. So pretty much right away, we realised that she was keen to get involved. She had tons of energy. She was smart. I think she's an accountant. I think that's her, or a bookkeeper. I think that's her job. So she's very articulate, and it just snowballed from there. She's, you know, got 20 or 30 people that work with us. She's got a dive team that we work with. She's got connections with the local council or whatever the government organisation over there is. I'm not sure what the correct term is. And it just led to discussions about mangroves, and she went and got us areas of the beach allocated that we could use to plant mangroves. You know, so she's very resourceful, and that's what we need at the beach. We need people all over the world like that, that we can reach out, we can empower them, because that's all we're doing. We've just gave her the chance to go and do what's probably been inside her all her life, but she's never had that opportunity. And gave her that opportunity, and she's away and creating a whole community out there that's I mean, they've all got their T-shirts, you know, we've been helping out with tools, because obviously when before you plant mangroves, you've got to clear the area of all the debris, and, you know, some of it's pretty full on, so you've obviously got a bit of gloves on, and you need some cutting tools and, you know, stuff like that. And same with the divers, you know, we've made sure they've got flippers, you know, and they've not got like, sort of boots or shoes on that are going to damage the reef, so we try and make sure that they've all got the appropriate safety equipment or whatever, as best we can, because obviously we're remote, we don't actually have a beach representative over in the Philippines as such. But so that's all we're really doing, is just reaching out to people
and supporting
them. Yeah, we're almost fishing for a bite, and if we get a bite and have a discussion with them, they're desperate to help their community, or you know, they want to do their bit, and then you just give the people the opportunity, and it's infectious. You know, you've seen a lot of the media that we've put out, and it's just, you watch these videos and you're like, I can't believe how they've managed to do this. So there was a beach clean a couple of weeks ago, and they took 320 kilos off a beach, and then they had to walk across, I'm going to say, let's say it was 100 yards of water to get to the main beach. And then they had mopeds. Obviously, it was a fair distance to the town. Then they had mopeds that was taking all the waste back to the town to get disposed of. You know, it was almost like a military operation. You know? So it's...
And you're supporting them financially to do that then?
Well, there's obviously the costs involved, Mark, with some of the materials, and there is a small payment, usually in tokens or whatever. You know, we try and help people. It's not helping them; it's empowering them. You know, so but it's not a lot of money. You know, and I think the thing that sums it up is I was on a voice call the other night, and on the Telegram, and somebody from the community asked, would we consider advertising in Times Square? You know, because you see Floki doing it, you see Doge doing it. You see all the big tokens, the five or six, you know, big tokens, they all advertise in Times Square. Now, I'm going to assume that costs, let's say, $50,000 a day. I don't know how much it costs, Mark, but I think that's about the ballpark price to get one of these big...
Easily.
Yeah, probably more. And I just said to that person, I said, first of all, right away, the carbon, you know, to have that going for 24 hours, you know, it's just mind-blowing what the carbon would be. And then I said, how many mangroves can we plant with $50,000? We could probably get 100,000 mangroves. Now, that sounds like a ridiculous number. But they just done 1,500 at the weekend.
Wow.
And, you know, in a 3 or 4 hour session. So you imagine if you could actually build it up to two a week, and you could quickly get 10,000 a week, no problem. And the thing is as well, Mark, we get, people keep saying to us, when are you doing marketing? I say, well, our projects are our marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time somebody cleans a beach or plants mangroves, we're getting a story, we're getting marketing. We're getting media. And you know what? In a month's time, they'll go back and they'll film where they planted the mangroves. And you'll see this mangrove that was a sapling that'll now be, I'm going to say, a couple of feet, for instance. So right away, you've got a story that's, you know, it's almost like a soap opera. There'll be an episode every month to see how things have progressed. So that's our marketing. And then some people can't get their head around about it, but I think it's the best marketing out there. It's a winner chicken dinner for everybody, as far as I'm concerned.
No, that's good. Yeah, and to see that kind of it's your marketing's from the stories. You're not spending loads of money marketing or sending film crews around the world to create beautiful marketing videos. It's coming directly from the people that are doing it, the community.
They're authentic, you know. Mm. So we do very little of the editing. It's actually the people on the ground that are doing the editing, and some of the stuff that they're producing is just mind blowing, the quality as well. So
Yeah. And I think if I can add, I think it speaks volumes again, going back for, you know, 15, 20 minutes ago when I mentioned and was asked the question, why Beach? Why involve myself in Beach? And I said, well, you know, it's a great project, great use, but in the end, it's the people. It speaks volumes when we want to take our resources, limited resources, and we want to use them for the mission. Because as you do that, it's going to take you a little longer to grow organically, but you will, because, you know, I mean, and I wrote this in the main group this morning. I said, there's a point at which every project reaches what I like to call critical mass. And when you reach critical mass, is now you have enough people who are excited about the project. And you didn't have to go to Times Square with $50,000 advertisements. You didn't have to spend an inordinate amount of money trying to grow the token. What you were instead doing with the limited amount of resources that you have is you were trying to grow the company and to grow the mission and actually accomplish things. So it's going to take a little bit longer, but it's better growth in the end, that organic growth. You're going to get people, you know, people are sticky. And if you get sticky people like you guys and like me, I'm not leaving this project. Hey man, I'm as sticky as they come, because I believe in this thing. And I think that the tiebreaker is you got to have a belief system. And once you create that belief system, and I'm sorry, I'm yelling. Let me lean away from I'm sorry, but let me lean away from the microphone here. But I'm passionate. And we talked about this, Kenny, one of the first times we ever spoke. And I know you could, the passion resonated with you, because, you know, once we get people who are excited about this thing, you want to share it. And I've shared it with a number of my people in my groups. And a lot of my investing friends, I've said, guys, here's a project you want to be a part of. I've talked to my fraternal organizations about this group. I've stood before a group of American Legionnaires and I've said, let me tell you about a project that I'm personally involved in. And they just thought that was awesome. People want to be a part of something that's bigger than them. And so I think that, you know, good answer, Kenny, in the group talking about and not wanting to spend that kind of money on advertisement, that'll come. It'll come.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think as well, it's also worth pointing out that the Beach token is not the project. The token is just the currency of the project. Yeah. We've got a bigger master plan called the Beach Collective, which will encompass Beach Shop, Beach Pay, Beach Gig, and various other ideas that they've got as well. So there's a lot of smart people, a lot smarter than me, behind it, and some of the ideas that are coming out are just mind blowing. Just to give an example, Mark, you know that for my sins, and maybe I'll regret it, but I have taken on a cafe in my local train station. It's a bit left field from my usual investing strategy, but we've taken it on, and I've decided that everything in it's going to be, you know, all the cups that we bought are compostable. You know, as much as I can, I'm going to try and not use any single use plastics within the within the cafe. But the Beach Collective will allow me, hopefully next year, I could take Beach tokens. You could walk up, Mark, because you've got Beach tokens. Some new company.
I do. I was just going to ask you, will you take Beach tokens?
Yes. So hopefully by the time you get your finger out your backside and you get back to Scotland in 2022, hopefully the facility will be set up. You'll walk up and say, Kenny, can I have some of your finest Italian aroma roast coffee? Well, it wouldn't be me, because I'm not physically running it. I've got somebody else to run it. But you'll meet him, and he's a character. And you'll say, I would like to pay with Beach tokens, please. And you'll do it.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to that day, Kenny.
Yeah, and it won't just be for buying products; it'll be services as well. So, I mean, there's just so many ideas. The blockchain revolution is fantastic for this. It's, as you said in our podcast a couple of weeks ago, Mark. You know, this is like an internet moment all over again. Mm-hmm. So, as you know, it's not even mainstream yet. I mean, I don't know what the percentage uptake is in crypto at the moment, but It's not even hit the retail market. There's so many people scared of it, and rightly so, because there's a lot of Wild West stuff goes on in the crypto space, and I've seen it myself. But at some point, you will have to go on that horse, because it's not going away.
No,
not at all.
No, it's not. It'll have its peaks and troughs, but it's definitely not going away.
Yeah. It's about the internet. You know, we can't live without it now. You know, I mean, what would happen if the internet went down worldwide?
Yeah,
you know, it would just.
Yeah.
It would.
The genie is out of the bottle.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, Mike. But. Good stuff.
No, that's been good. Thank you both for your time there. Not usually I thank the co-host for his time as well, but
I know it's a strange one, because this is about the third or fourth podcast where I've had to sort of sit on both sides of the conversation, and sometimes it's quite tricky because I was drifting right across the beach there, and then sometimes you've got to try and drag yourself back into stock box. But yeah, it's been good fun.
It has been good, yeah. And it'd be nice to keep tabs and catch up on the stories and talk to other people who are doing these initiatives and see how it grows. But it's good to talk to you both today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Kenny.
No problem.
I appreciate the invite for being here, and I'll just close with this. Back in 2017, I met David Chalm. And it was educated a little bit on blockchain and cryptography and smart contracts through David out in San Diego through a special spatial conference that I attended. And I knew right then that this was going to change the world. And I wanted to be a part of it. I missed you know, General Electric in the 1800s. I just wasn't around for that. In large part, as I look at the major muscle movements technologically through the years, I've missed most of them, just didn't recognize what they were in time. But I'm very fortunate to have recognized early on that blockchain and cryptography are going to fundamentally change how we do what we do in the world. And I'm just really delighted to be a part of it on the deck plate level with Beach Token. So thanks, guys, and I appreciate the invite to be on the show today.
Excellent. It's been good talking to you, Mike.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Per Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.